podcasting technology of Normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com.
Almost busted in Laredo, but for reasons that I'd rather not disclose.
I smoke pot, and I like it a lot. Hi, this is Willie Nelson. I learned a long time ago that marijuana is a lot safer to use than alcohol. There's absolutely nothing wrong with the responsible use of marijuana by adults. It's time we stopped arresting and started respecting responsible marijuana smokers in America. And to learn what you can do to help, please contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORMAL.
The show was long and we were just sitting there, and we'd come to play and not just for the ride.
Distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular audio podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, normalaudiostash.com. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. Welcome back to Normal's Daily Audio Stash today. It is Tuesday, September 11th, 2007. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment to join us at Normal to help end marijuana prohibition in America. We can do it together. Just make your donation or join Normal today right up at norml.org. We're also about 4 weeks away from the Normal Annual Conference taking place this year in Los Angeles, California. Notable Normal Advisory Board members such as Tommy Chong will be there, along with marijuana activists and advocates from around the country, taking place in a number of special panels. More information about this year's conference is available right up at normal.org. We also have direct links to it at normalaudiostash.com. You can check out some of the speakers, speeches, and notable events from last year's conference in our special Normal Event podcast, as well as some special Normal News podcasts we did last year. We're going to have 100% full coverage of this year's Normal Conference right here on Normal's Daily Audio Stash, along with special events feeds again this year. On the program today, we have a special September 11th show that features music from Ani DeFranco and an interview with Keith Strupp, Normal's founder. We interviewed Keith last year for the September 11th anniversary to have him tell us about his experience in Washington that day. Keith, Alan St. Pierre, Normal's executive director, and Paul Armentano, Normal's senior policy analyst, were all actually at the Capitol complex going through security when the attack on the Pentagon occurred. They were there that day for the confirmation hearing of drug czar John Walters. So we'll hear that interview with Keith again today. Also, for our September 11th show last year, we got permission from Ani DeFranco's record company and management company to play the song Self-Evident right here on the podcast. It's a song I've used on my own public radio programs around the 9/11 anniversary each year. And it's a privilege to be able to bring you this song again here today on Normal's Daily Audio Stash. We have links to Ani DeFranco's record label and to her up on iTunes, as well as to the track we'll play today, Self-Evident, right up on our website at normalaudiostash.com. Let's get to our interview now with Keith Strupp as he tells us what happened in Washington on September 11th, 2001. Thanks very much again for joining us today. Keith, I know you and the staff were inside the Capitol complex when the attacks occurred. Tell us about your experience that day.
Well, I had seen, like most Americans who were up early, I had seen the first plane, maybe even the second plane, crash into the World Trade Center. But at that point, as far as we knew, it was something that was limited only to New York City. And I was scheduled, frankly, I'm having a little trouble remembering here as I get old. I was going to a legislative hearing. I believe it was the House Judiciary Committee, and it was in the House Rayburn Building, which is literally just across the street from the Capitol. And they have a fairly tight security even prior to 9/11. And so there were two or three other people with me from the normal office, and what I remember is a couple of them had already cleared security and were walking up the steps to go to the elevator, and I was taking a little longer, I think, because I had a couple of bags with me they had to go through. And just as I finally cleared security, an alarm went off, and I started hearing people shouting, "The building is being evacuated. The building is being evacuated." Frankly, I wasn't sure immediately whether it was connected to the Twin Towers fiasco we had seen on television that morning. But what I had seen before I went over to the hearing were the plane went into one of the buildings. I don't even think I saw the second, and I'm certain I hadn't seen the buildings fall. At any event, we didn't have much choice. They turned us around and ran us out of the building. And, of course, as I got out of the building, I realized that it wasn't just our building, but it was every building on Capitol Hill people were fleeing from, and in a kind of frenetic fashion that told all of us this is not just an alarm. This is something to be concerned about. And so we walked and half ran all the way to the train station, which is a couple of blocks away, Union Station, which is where the subway line connects to the Capitol anyway. And I think it was once we got there, I don't know if somebody either by their cell phone or on a radio or whatever, but had picked up on the fact that we were being evacuated because they were concerned about one of those planes may in fact be aiming at the U.S. Capitol. So it was, you know, for a few minutes it was frightening. It wasn't, it wasn't personally frightening very long because we were sort of out of the target's way there pretty quickly. But it certainly did seem momentous. I mean, to be at the nation's capital, going in for a legislative hearing, one of the sort of things that governs policy in our nation, and to realize that because of an act of some terrorists that we didn't even know who they were, they could shut the entire government down. It was really one of those moments where it kind of took your breath, and we hopped on a subway and made it back to the normal office, and like everybody else, spent the rest of the day watching television, trying to figure out just what piece of this we had seen in Washington.
And had you seen the Pentagon throughout the day?
Well, later that day, of course, I mean, before very long, by the time we got back to the normal office, we were aware of the Pentagon. The plane had gone into the Pentagon. Where I live is actually not far from there at all, probably 2 or 3 miles, but I had gone into work early enough that there was no problem at the Pentagon when I had gone near it. But of course, as I say, once we got back to the normal office and it was 24-hour coverage on all the channels, we were aware. In fact, it was that plane that hit the Pentagon was the one they were particularly worried about. Maybe it was going to hit the Capitol. And of course, also the one in Pennsylvania that ended up crashing in a field in Pennsylvania also appeared to be heading back to Washington, D.C. Nobody knew for sure what they were aiming at, but everybody knew the number one target either had to be the White House or the Capitol. And Washington, downtown Washington, is not that big an area, so I can assure you the normal office is literally 2 blocks from the White House. So we were all quite sensitive to the fact that we were at some sort of target central, and we weren't sure what we had done to deserve it or what we needed to do to avoid it in the future, but it sure did feel like we were on somebody's bullseye.
And Keith, after spending over 30 years in Washington, D.C., what was your sense of the people who lived there in the city that day and for the next 48 hours, perhaps?
Well, it was the scariest time, certainly. The only other time, and again, you're right, I came out actually about 41 years ago. I was a freshman. I came out to go to law school. I was a freshman in law school in 1965 at Georgetown. And the only other scary time I've ever had in the District of Columbia was when the riots occurred. Frankly, I can't remember precisely what years those were, but they were in the early 70s. I was a second or third year law student, so they were in the late 60s, I guess. 65 or 66. And there were a couple of days there where there were some downtown areas right by the law firm I worked at and right near Georgetown Law School where, you know, there were stores burning and there were people shot in the street. It was really a kind of a frightening time. That's the only other time until this 9/11 incident where I'd ever felt unsafe in the District of Columbia, but I certainly did. And there were lots of friends right after 9/11, frankly, that just got the hell out of town, figured that that was no place they wanted to be hanging around until we figured out just how persistent this threat was going to be. You know, keep in mind, when this happened, nobody quite knew, were those the only planes? Were there another group of planes that were going to come in after that? We didn't know how comprehensive the attack might be. And so people rested not terribly well for a couple of days until we had a better understanding of what had happened and what was likely to happen.
Keith, so what made you stay? You said you immediately went to the Normal office just a few blocks away from the White House itself. What made you stay rather than flee the city?
Well, for one thing, once you got away literally from, you know, if you were standing in front of the White House, I certainly would have walked a few blocks further away, or if you were over by the Capitol. But otherwise, even if there were other planes that were going to attack, the likelihood they were going to hit the building your office is in didn't seem very great, frankly. It's sort of like some people have said to me, I was going to be traveling today, and it was the 5th anniversary, and a couple of people said, geez, are you sure you want to travel on 9/11? Well, you know, I don't know, there's something like 30,000 planes a day fly around the United States, and so it's possible that there will be one or two that somebody hijacks and crashes into a building, but if that were to happen, as sad as that would be, frankly, the chances that it's going to be the plane you're on are not very great. You're probably running more of a risk when you walk across the street. So I once I got away from the Capitol, I didn't feel personally in danger. And frankly, it was, I don't know, it almost seemed like the center of everything. I wanted to know more about it. I wanted to know who were these people. Well, you know, what did we know about them? Did we know anything? And somehow sitting in Washington, D.C., watching the news 24 hours a day made you feel like you were part of the action, even though obviously you were seeing the same thing as if you'd been in Casper, Wyoming. But it always feels like you're a little closer to power there. So I found it sort of comforting to be there, frankly. I didn't want to run away. I wanted to know what the hell was going on. But as I say, what happened is it's almost like the details of what you were working on that day faded in importance because of the incredible change in the mood of the country at that point. I mean, obviously, we've never recovered. Sure, we've cleared the damage from the buildings, and at least in Washington, we've rebuilt, and in New York, I assume eventually they will get that space rebuilt again. But I don't think there's any way to take the country back to that sort of relative innocence that we were at prior to that attack. The first World Trade Center bombing, because it didn't bring a building down and because it was sort of localized, I think there were only 5 or 6 people who were actually killed, didn't really scare the rest of the country. But I think without question that what happened on 9/11 changed all of our lives, and I don't think we'll ever be back to that innocent point again. I'm sorry, that loss of innocence is something that I think we miss, but I don't think there's any way to replace it.
Keith, you mentioned this loss of innocence. I know they had periodically deployed Patriot missile batteries on the Mall in the following weeks. Do the residents of Washington think about terrorism every day now?
Well, I'll tell you why you are reminded of it routinely, is because, for example, prior to 9/11, when you drove through Washington, you could drive on Pennsylvania Avenue right in front of the White House. You could drive on the other side of the White House, and it was East Street. And all of my life, when I went to Georgetown Law School, I drove by the White House every morning going to school. People, tourists walked right up to the, you know, the thing. Well, once 9/11 came along, they literally closed those streets to vehicular traffic. That two-block-long section of Pennsylvania Avenue not only has never reopened, but never will. They've now made it into a pedestrian mall. There now are people with wide-angle lenses and automatic weapons on top of the White House. And when you go, just as a tourist, when you go to the White House, you will frequently see those weapons and those men up on top of the roof of the White House. So it's almost like it's a version of what we all have had to adjust to when we go to the airport. Washington, D.C., and the monuments and all of those things are simply no longer as open and as free as they used to be. Now there are a lot more military around, there are a lot more guns and police, and some of the places you just can't get up close to. They consider it too big a risk. So I don't think people live in fear, but they certainly are reminded on a daily basis in Washington that there are people who would like to drop a big one right in the heart of Washington, D.C. And so there is a sense that we've had to give up some of our civil liberties in order to attain a certain level of safety. Now, I'm not someone who necessarily agrees with all those trade-offs we've made. In fact, many of them I don't agree with. Many of the things Bush has done I don't think are constitutional, and I don't think are valid trade-offs. But nonetheless, we've made them as a country. And I don't imagine we will ever go back in the other direction. I suspect any civil liberties we've given up, such as, you know, being able to run at the last minute and get on an airplane without somebody searching your bag and putting you through a special machine, I don't think we'll ever have a time again when we can run and catch a plane at the last minute. That's just one of the things we lost.
I have to wonder now, too, Keith, are we perhaps gaining a greater appreciation for freedom now, you know, 5 years later, after having seen the attacks, the response of war, and the Patriot Act? I have to wonder if in Washington, among the politicos, maybe we cherish freedom more and want to fight to get it back?
Well, I think on two levels you may have made a valid point there. One is that obviously when you feel under attack, the country is more united and more willing to fight for a common goal, and that common goal would be, you know, to make sure that the country survives and that our democracy survives and that our way of life generally survives. So I think there is a bit of that. But even a little more subtle, what I have noticed just in the last few months is when Bush was caught with dealing with prisoners in a way which seemed to violate international protocols and treaties, yet he didn't seem to have any trouble with it. He wasn't even willing to admit we had those secret prisons for a long time. And then when the Supreme Court finally called him up on it and said, wait a minute, you can't treat those people like that. They have to be charged. They have to be brought to trial, whatever. There are a number of members of Congress who have taken a look at the proposal that Bush sent to Congress last week, and some of those people are conservatives and some of them are Republicans, people that I'm not used to being on the same side of the issue, and they're beginning to speak up and saying, no, we cannot, we can't authorize criminal trials where people can spend the rest of their life in prison, but somehow they're not entitled to hear the evidence against them? How in the hell could you have a justice system where the defendant doesn't know what he's being accused of or what facts are being presented, so obviously he can't defend himself? So, yes, I do believe that there are some elected officials who are thoughtful enough that this has caused them to go back and get in touch with some basic concepts, which maybe they were a little lazy about before the attack. So maybe that's a little bit of good that has come out of it, although I think you have to stretch to think there's been a lot of good coming out of it.
And one final question today, Keith. Some have drawn the parallel between the drug war and the war on terror, and that a lot of the rhetoric and practice of the war on terror comes from the war on drugs. How do you see that?
Well, certainly, in some ways, I think the war on terror has forced the government establishment to take some of that money they used to be spending trying to catch and identify and arrest and prosecute marijuana smokers, for example, and they simply can't afford to spend all that money on these silly, trivial things. When we're feeling like our very democracy is at stake and our freedom is at stake, even those law and order types realize marijuana enforcement has to take a second level, maybe a third level. So there probably is some of that going on, but the other side, of course, is you have John Walters. You mentioned that it was apparently his confirmation hearing 5 years ago that we were trying to get to when this happened. John Walters, even just a few months ago, was still claiming that if you smoke marijuana, you support terrorism. Now, what an outrageous and stupid accusation to make. First off, the vast majority of marijuana that is smoked in this country is grown in this country. We have the most sophisticated cultivation techniques in the world. We grow the best marijuana in the world. There's no reason to import it, for Christ's sake. It's all grown indoors now. And so every state in the union, there's good quality marijuana available year-round. And I know who benefits when I buy marijuana. It's some young entrepreneur in Northern California, frankly, and he doesn't have anything to do with terrorism. So it was a stupid thing to say. In addition, that marijuana that is imported comes almost entirely from three countries, Canada, Mexico, and Jamaica. And none of those three countries are on the list of terrorist-supporting countries. So at some point, I would hope that Congress would insist that John Walters apologize for that stupid allegation, but instead he keeps coming, bringing it back. I think at least on two different occasions he's had a major campaign in which he, through advertisements, ads in magazines and on television, he's tried to convince the rest of America that if you smoke marijuana, you're supporting terrorism. That's just simply a sleazy attempt to somehow benefit the war on drugs, or grab the war on drugs and move it along as part of the war on terrorism. They have nothing in common whatsoever. If, in fact, what he's saying is that if you spend money on products where the money goes to the Middle East, for example, then what we ought to say is if you drive a gas-guzzling SUV, you are supporting terrorism, because you are. That money goes to the Middle East.
Keith, many thanks again for taking time today from Florida to join us here and share your experience.
Thank you very much.
Keith Strupp is Normal's founder. The Normal offices are located just two blocks from the White House on K Street Northwest in Washington, D.C. Next up today, we have a track from Ani DeFranco. On a personal note, I produce public radio programming and have used this next track around the anniversary of 9/11 for a few years now. The track does not reflect the view of the foundation or its staff, but as the producer, I've been given the creative freedom today to showcase this important piece of American music and poetry. It's called Self-Evident, and it's a very powerful piece. We have links to the album and to Ani DeFranco on iTunes at normalaudiostash.com. Thanks to Righteous Babe Records and the Music Alliance, as well as Alan St. Pierre, for allowing me to showcase this track for you today. Here is Ani DeFranco and Self-Evident.
Us people are just poems. We're 90% metaphor, with a leanness of meaning approaching hyperdistillation. And once upon a time, we were moonshine, rushing down the throat of a giraffe. Yes, rushing down the long hall, despite what the PA announcement says. Yes, rushing down the long hall, down the long stairs in a building so tall that it will always be there. It's part of a pair, there on the bow of Noah's Ark. The most prestigious couple just kicking back, parked against a perfectly blue sky on a morning beatific in its Indian summer breeze, on the day that America fell to its knees after strutting around for a century without saying thank you or please. And the shock was subsonic and the smoke was deafening between the setup and the punchline. Because we were all on time for work that day. We all boarded that plane for to fly. And then while the fires were raging, we all climbed up on the windowsill. And then we all held hands and jumped into the sky. And every burrow looked up when it heard the first blast. And then every dumb action movie was summarily surpassed. And the exodus uptown by foot and motor car looked more like war than anything I've seen so far. So far. So far. So far. So fierce and ingenious, a poetic specter so far gone that every jackass newscaster was struck dumb and stumbling over, oh my God, and this is unbelievable, and on and on. And I'll tell you what, while we're at it, you can keep the Pentagon, you can keep the propaganda, you can keep each and every TV that's been trying to convince me to participate in some prep school punk's plan to perpetuate retribution. Perpetuate retribution. Even as the blue toxic smoke of our lesson in retribution is still hanging in the air, and there's ash on our shoes. And there's ash in our hair. And there's a fine silt on every mantle from Hell's Kitchen to Brooklyn. And the streets are full of stories, sudden twists and near misses. And soon every open bar is crammed to the rafters with tales of narrowly averted disasters. And the whiskey is flowing like never before, as all over the country, folks just shake their heads and pour.
We'll be right back.
a toast to all the folks that live in Palestine, Afghanistan, Iraq, El Salvador. Here's a toast to all the folks living on the Pine Ridge Reservation under the stone cold gaze of Mount Rushmore. Here's a toast to all those nurses and doctors who daily provide women with a choice, who stand down a threat the size of Oklahoma City just to listen to a young woman's voice. Here's a toast to all those folks on death row right now, awaiting the executioner's guillotine, who are shackled there with dread and can only escape into their heads to find peace in a form of a dream. Peace in a form of a dream. Peace in a form of a dream. Cause take away our PlayStations and we are a third world nation under the thumb of some blue blood royal son who stole the Oval Office and that phony election. I mean, it don't take a weatherman to look around and see the weather. Jeb said he'd deliver Florida, folks, and boy, did he ever. And we hold these truths to be self-evident. Number one, George W. Bush is not president. Number two, America is not a true democracy. And number three, the media is not fooling me. Cause I am a poem heeding hyperdistillation, and I've got no room for a lie so verbose. Yeah. Yes, I'm looking out over my whole human family, and I'm raising my glass in a toast. Here's to our last drink of fossil fuels. May we vow to get off of this sauce. Shoo away the swarms of commuter planes. Find that train ticket we lost. Cause once upon a time, the line followed the river and peeked into all the backyards. And the laundry was waving and the graffiti was teasing us from brick walls and bridges. We were rolling over ridges through valleys under stars. I dream of touring like Duke Ellington in my own railroad car. Yeah. Of waiting on the tall, blonde wooden benches in a grand station aglow with grace, and then standing out on the platform and feeling the air on my face. Give back the night its distant whistle, give the darkness back its soul, give the big oil companies the finger finally, and relearn how to rock and roll. Yes, the lessons are all around us, and the truth is waiting there. It's time to pick through the rubble, clean the streets, and clear the air. Get our government to pull its big dick out of the sand of someone else's desert. Put it back in his pants with the hypocritical chants of freedom forever. Cause when one lone phone rang in 2001 at 10 after 9 on 911, which was the number we all call when that lone phone rang right off the wall, right off our desk and down the long hall, down the long stairs in a building so tall that the whole world turned just to watch it fall. While we're at it, remember the first time around? The bomb, the rider truck, the parking garage, the princess that didn't even feel the pee. Remember joking around in our apartment on Avenue D? Can you imagine how many paper coffee cups would have to change their design following a fantastical reversal of the New York skyline? It was a joke at the time. And that was just a few years ago, so Let the record show that the FBI was all over that case, that the plot was obvious and in everybody's face. And scoping that scene religiously, the CIA, or is it KGB, committing countless crimes against humanity with this kind of eventuality as its excuse for abuse after expensive abuse, and they didn't have a clue. Look, another window to see through. Way up here on 104th floor, look, another key, another door. 10% literal, 90% metaphor. 3,000 some poems disguised as people. On an almost too perfect day, must be more than pawns in some asshole's passion play. So now it's your job, and it's my job, to make it that way, to make sure they didn't die in vain. Shh, baby, listen. Hear the train.
That was Ani DeFranco and Self-Evident, here on Normal's Daily Audio Stash today. It's from Ani DeFranco's album, So Much Shouting, So Much Laughter. We have links to the album and Ani on iTunes at normalaudiostash.com. Thanks again to Righteous Babe Records, The Music Alliance, and Alan St. Pierre for allowing me to showcase this track today. Listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about every day's show. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 4:20 tomorrow.
Percent of Americans no longer support arresting and jailing marijuana smokers, and nearly as many support the medical patients having access to medical marijuana, and over 80% of our citizens now believe the war on drugs is an ineffective failure. So the question is, when will the government's misguided war on adult marijuana smokers finally end? When? Simple. When you and your like-minded friends, family, and coworkers get involved with an organization such as the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, also known as NORML. My name is Keith Strop, and I founded the organization in 1970. Contact us at NORML, toll-free, 888-67-NORML, or by visiting the organization's up-to-date webpage at www.normal.org.